Okay, so essentially I'm just going to pull a name from the hat. That person is up, and it is game on.
That was taped from a storytelling event here in Kansas City called Flame. There, people jump up onto stage and share a four-minute story. Presenting is exhilarating, and listening can be just as thrilling. Storytelling is the foundation of what makes us human. But recently, there's also been more of a focus on the art of storytelling, with events like Flame, The Moth, and the National Storytelling Convention, which is happening here in Kansas City next week. Being in the storytelling business, we, of course, have been nerding out about what makes a great story and thinking about how we tell stories. I'm Matthew Law Milton, and this is Central Standard. And today, helping us do some of that exploring is Lillian Rodriguez Peng. She's a professional storyteller and will be speaking at the National Storytelling Conference next Wednesday. Lily, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Yes. And you just got here from Australia, correct?
Yes.
So a little early in the morning in your brain.
It is. It is quite an opposite time zone to be existing in right now.
But I'm curious, how do you make a living traveling the world as a professional storyteller? I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, there's a story. I perform with storytelling. I have two sides to my storytelling. One is the straight performance side, where I can go into theatres or events. I have a couple of theatre shows that I've sold or tour. I have a performance repertoire that I can take into festivals or, you know, theatre festivals or schools or events around the country, around Australia. I also work with storytelling, so that's my other side. So I do a lot of regular work with groups with storytelling. So some of that regular work is once a week I do a session with a mental health group, and once a week I do a session with refugees recently arrived. So I have a regular system of storytelling as well that I commit to in one location. I also work for a theatre company as a storyteller, getting local stories onto stage.
It sounds like you're doing a lot of scrambling.
I do a lot of beautiful pieces and they come together and none of it is the 9-to-5 doldrums.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that you do performances and that kind of thing. So is your storytelling more fiction or more nonfiction or some kind of cross in between?
Oh, gosh. All stories are true.
Even the fantasies.
Of course. The reason why we love them is because they hold to a universal truth. Mm-hmm. So there is truth in all stories. In terms of performance, it depends on what I'm doing. I have a Fringe Festival show that I did. It was a one woman. It was about the women in my life, like following a bloodline, looking at...
Was this Fringe? But this was Fringe in Australia?
This was in Australia, yeah. So it was by Fringe Festival. Sorry, because I'm getting terminology here is a little bit different.
Oh, okay.
But for me, that means that it's a quick one-person pack-in, pack-out show that can go into any space. Mm-hmm. So that mixed, you know, true stories with folktale. And that is what I like to do. I like to mix the two genres together. For me, that is very, very important.
Why?
Because I feel that what defines a part of my storytelling and the way that I can work with stories is that the universal truth of stories that are thousands of years old that came and survive and live orally before books, before media, before radio, before internet, that truth is what makes stories continue to live. That's what connects us. That's what we find in our heart and our spirit. So when I connect my story or somebody else's story to that universal truth, then we create a community.
Is it one universal? I find it interesting. You're talking about like these big ideas, right? Like this universal truth. But in your mind, is that like one story, one moral, or is it like a bunch of different morals and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a bunch of things that when it hits, like if you take, say someone's telling you a big story, it's a huge story, and when
like,
you take
for example,
down...
Like an epic?
An epic, but even if it's a story from their life, you know, everyone has epics within their life. We all come with a whole range of stories, and that epic might be, you know, I flew into New York, and there are amazing stories in New York of people who have come to this country, who have set up, who don't know anyone else, who succeed, who work hard, who fight loneliness, who fight, you know, their strength. Unbelievable. They're epic stories. But the universal truth of that is that when we break that story down, the thing that I find in there that all of us can relate to, whether we've migrated to another country or not, is that they've struggled against loneliness and they've won. Hmm. There's the universal truth. And that story comes out in a whole range of folktales where someone has ended up out on their own and are fundamentally lonely but still come through at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So the two of them are linked. Mm. And that's the universal truth. Now, that's not the same truth that is this line or that story or any. But when, for me, the universal truth is when we break something down into those couple of words, when you really hit the core or the heart of it, that's when you're speaking to a truth.
Did you start as a storyteller?
Nah.
Even though you've given it so much thought, well, where's the start for you?
I was born in Australia, but my family come from El Salvador. So there was a migration, older siblings born overseas, all of that. So I was born and raised in Australia as an immigrant, as a first, setting up. And I was very interested in that process, you know, of that migration and the economics and everything. So I actually studied economics and politics, 2 degrees side by side at ANU and Australia's National University. It's very posh. It's very fantastic university. It's actually brilliant.
Masters or PhD or?
I got through it.
Yeah,
okay, I passed.
Okay, great.
But what I wanted to do was save the world with economics. Because of this wars and third world nations and everything that was going on. So the diplomacy of politics and the economics, because I figured by that stage, and I'd gone back to El Salvador when I was 15 and et cetera, et cetera. So I'd figured that basically our world problems are economics and politics. And I really wanted to study politics, but then I thought, actually can't do that without the other one and really know what's going on, you know, because they're too intertwined. So I studied those. And then I went and I travelled. I worked in El Salvador with a cousin. I went to Kenya, worked in the slum schools program there and came back to Australia after travelling for a bit when my brother became ill. My mother called me. My brother had developed schizophrenia. Now, if I look back in hindsight, which is such a wonderful thing, it was there for a while. The problems were surfacing. And my brother was my closest friend on this earth. He was...
Older or younger?
He was only 2 years older than me, where I'm one of four. And we were the ones who did everything together. I admired him. I loved him. And so I came back and got a job as an economist and was working, doing that career line of things, and had this side-by-side incredible process going on of witnessing my brother's illness, being caught up in that world, questioning reality, questioning what I know, who I know, what is love, who is this person, why is his truth any more incorrect than my truth? You know, why was he being doubted but I'm not? And all of those things, which are huge questions. Anyway, eventually, years down the track, he's in institutions, he's locked up. This is 20-odd years ago. This is not a good place. I'm sitting there. I love this guy. I don't know what to say. Like, I would visit him in the institutions and all I had was fear. I had so much fear that what I would talk about would trigger something in him and make him unwell, send him off, you know. So,
well, if he was already, how unwell was he?
Well, enough to be locked up against his will.
Yeah.
Which isn't cool. So I was afraid that, like, if I said, "Oh, I've just been for a surf," he can't do that. He's locked up against his will. Mm. "Oh, it's a great day out there." He can't figure that out. He's locked up in a concrete building with one little courtyard that has two pot plants in it. "Oh, you know, I did this today." He can't do that. He can't access it. He can't read the medication. He can't taste his food. It's everything I felt like was just a counteraction to what he was going through and exposing, like, what he was going through, like a match. So one day, through all this fear of years of this stuff, I sat down next to him with nothing to say, completely just in, locked up in fear. And I looked up and the moon was out in the daytime. And I said to him, "Oh, do you remember the story my grandmother used to tell?" My grandmother's a Pipil Indian, El Salvador, used to tell us about the moon when it's out early. And he's like, for the first time, he turned around, he looked me in the eye and he answered me. He said, "Yeah." It was like kaboom, connection, we're on. And we started talking about the moon and started trying to piece the parts of this story together. And so from then on, I rushed out. I started researching stories. This wasn't internet. This wasn't, I'm calling everyone. I'm bringing them back into the institution. The more I do that, the more people are sitting around me, the more people are greeting me when we come in and we're sitting down. And that was going on constantly. And I thought, well, I'm onto something here. And it became that, you know, I would take whatever theme they wanted. You know, what I found within the institution and everyone that was there, including with my brother, that they could go off on a theme really well. Like, we could disappear into stories. You know, there was a whole period, months and months, of going off on Alexander the Great stories, really massive epic stories, but everyone was into it. So I had to do heaps of research. But we would go off on these stories and the stories would keep going and going and going. And what I found, what I was actually doing, is trying to find threads and pull them back. And it became about grounding the story. How do they could get lost easy, but how do you pull back? How do you come together? How do you find your thread?
And do you mean back to what we would call reality? Like, is that what you're referring to? Or back? What do you mean by back? Back to where?
You know, reality is such
a dirty word.
It's not a dirty word. It's just such a personal concept. Mm. I think come back to that point in the story, because that's all we can do at any point in our lives, is come back to our point in that story. And sometimes that's a good place and that story has a great solution and an ending. And sometimes it just has a resolution and we keep going. But a resolution is very important. Stories that are open-ended and keep going, that we never feel settled in, that we never find our place within, that we never get a resolution, are stories that hurt us. Are stories that we can be lost in, are stories that, you know.
Can you give me an example of one?
Of a story that can
like,
hurt us?
A story that can hurt us.
Yeah, okay. I was an immigrant into Australia. We lived in a housing commission area, public housing. It's rough. It's full on. It was very violent, very, very violent. My oldest brother, against our race, like against my colour, my skin, my oldest brother, my mother and my second brother all were hospitalized with racial beatings. I was beaten up consistently. We were told to go home, get out of here. You're not one of us. You don't sound like one of us. Put into ESL classes when I could speak English. Like, so all of those sort of things. Now, I could lose myself in that story. I could be that story. I could be that respondent. And I became violent. Like, I was rough. I was a fighter. My brother, who developed schizophrenia, wasn't. He crumbled. Now, I could still be a fighter. I could still rush at things. I could still blow up in your face. I could still have a hard-ass kind of perception to show you. But that's being lost in one version of one story. And to continue and to grow, I need to change that story. I need to find my resolution with that past. I need to say it's okay. I need to find people talk forgiveness, they talk whatever it is. But I have to find my point where I say, that person was a beautiful part of me that survived. And she's had her day. And now I continue on the other parts of me that want to grow. So that story's had its resolution. I don't discard her. That fighting I needed. But I honor her and I keep going on the next part of this story. Mm. I don't hold on to that story.
Do you help other people express their stories, or are you most interested in honing your own skill and craft, or do you think that they're related?
I like the two sides. So honing my skill and my craft is the performance. But what I love is expressing story with others. That's why I do the regular work. That's why I'm there every week. I'm part of a community. I love what develops when people can express their story and find connection with others and find similarity and difference and know that it's all good. Hmm. Yeah, I love that work.
Is it hard work?
It can be. Mm-hmm. It can be really... There's moments when I get lost in a lot of pain. I work a lot with Indigenous communities within Australia, and they have a lot of pain within the community. Very proud, very beautiful, very strong people who have survived a lot. Oh, my goodness. And there is pain. Stolen generations of people where the government took these children and put them in homes and used them for domestic service, and they're finding their identity and finding their story. And I love that work. I love it. And there's times where I feel so connected that I feel the pain. I'd rather feel the pain than not have those stories and develop and be heard and be shared. Because that's the only way we can break down racism and institutionalized or ideologies and things like that, is by sharing our stories.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the ways that you help people find and tell better stories? Like, are there usual traps that people fall into?
Okay, yeah, totally. So here's where we go back to the traditional story, because if we look at a traditional story, the reason why they've survived for so long is because of that structure. They've got brilliant structure. So I talk to that structure and then I place the personal story. So that's how the two always have to intertwine. It's mm-hmm. not just about me, it's about those traditionals and how we work them.
And You were mentioning those, starting with, do you start with that, like, universal? Mm. Like, is that where you start? Like, I need to find a story about, you know, surviving loneliness. Or is it that through the process of telling the story, you discover, oh, this is a story about surviving loneliness?
Bit of both.
Oh, really?
Sometimes, yeah. The National Storytelling Network has an SOS site. So I can email in and say, look, I'm going out to a remote community in Indigenous Australia, and who has story ideas? And people will email me back saying, oh, there's this story from this place and here's the text, and help each other out. Storytellers are wonderful that way. We want to connect. We want to help each other out. So there's those sort of systems where, okay, I know what situation, or I have a concept, as you never know, but I have a concept of where what situation I'm walking into, and I'm going to prepare with this, and I can ask for help from other storytellers. I can ask for help from librarians. I love librarians. I can ask for help from YouTube. I can ask for help from my family, my community. So I will go to my elders. I will go to those elders and talk to them, because they are the ones who hold so much. Mm. So they're the places I go. So yeah, that's kind of where I go and seek help. And that helps me to help others seek their story, identify their story.
Great. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll be joined by another professional storyteller who's worked on narratives of companies. And you can stay with us. Central Standard will be right back. It's Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and for Gina Kaufman. We're exploring the craft of storytelling, and we're joined by Lily Pang, a professional storyteller. And now we're going to introduce Molly Catron, who's also a professional storyteller. Molly, welcome.
Oh, happy to be here.
And Molly, like Lily, you had a roundabout way into professional storytelling. you were working at Eastman Kodak, right?
Yeah, Eastman Chemical Company, which was a subdivision of Eastman Kodak. I came from a family of storytellers, but I was a chemist there.
Well, I feel like professional storytelling has become like an in vogue profession lately. What were your parents doing that made them professional storytellers back in their day?
Well, I come not professional storytellers, but okay. I come from the South, which is just it's a part of conversation there. On one side of the family, it was stories about your roots, stories that tell you who you are and what you're about, and those stories were constantly repeated. On the other side of the family, it was cautionary tales, you know, things about what people did and what could happen, or God forbid that you would do something stupid. And then it would be repeated for generations and generations. So it was those kind of storytellers. But within those were the core, what I call fractals of life, and what Lily was referring to, that make up the basis of storytelling. They were country people, but they knew story. And so I was a chemist at Eastman. They pulled me off to do some training. It was early 80s. And they were trying to empower the membership. And so
What do you mean by empower the membership?
The people in the organization, empower mm-hmm. them, turn over, help them make decisions for themselves. We were moving from a rule-bound organization to a principle-based organization. Mm. And that was the very beginning of it. And they pulled me off, I think, because I came from the same roots as the operation people on the floor. You know, I knew their lingo. I could speak their language. And I made them laugh. And so as part of that, I found myself having to teach principles. And I would rely a lot on my grandpa's stories as I was teaching principles, because really what I was doing was doing character building. Because if you're rule bound, you don't necessarily have to have a lot of character. But if you're making decisions in, based on principles, integrity is a really big piece of it.
I suspect your grandfather had stories about integrity.
Definitely. Definitely stories about integrity. So the more I kept doing that, and the more my supervisors liked the fact that I was getting good ratings for the classes, the more I was drawn into it.
Mm-hmm. And so isn't that what you do full time?
Yes. Essentially? I moved the test by fire was when I was made manager over a large analytical lab with 51 direct reports. And then I was faced with applying a lot of the principles, using the stories not to just to teach, but to influence, you know. And from there, I was put in a group to work exclusively with corporate change.
So it seems to me like what you're suggesting is that stories work in this kind of profound way that they actually change us on the inside. Can you talk to me about that process? Because, for example, like if you were to tell me a story about your grandfather, he's your grandfather. He's not my grandfather. Mm-hmm. Like how is that supposed to change me?
Number one, I think everybody, you'll find elements of the same grandfather or the same elder that might influence you in all mm-hmm. of us. In fact, that's why stories work across cultures. If we're together and we tell stories about our grandmother, we'll see that grandmothers are usually grandmothers no matter where they come from. And we'll find out what's more alike about us than what's different. Mm. But when it comes to telling stories about principles, the core of the story is about the principle being acted upon, you know, what's happening, how it's played out. And the reason I think it works so well with change, people don't like to be changed. And so a story just presents the situation to them and they can see how it plays out. They'll usually come to their own conclusion. In fact, you don't tell them the answer to the story or necessarily what you were teaching. You want them to discover it. There is some processing, but you don't say, now here's what this story meant. Because mm-hmm. they like doing the mental work, the brain work. They like being able to come to that conclusion.
Right. And I'm curious, you know, is it glib to kind of talk about branding and you know, and a corporation about like changing its corporate culture? Or is that like kind of part of the deal?
You mean branding, the story that's told externally about the organization or the toy?
Yeah.
I haven't worked that much with marketing. in particular. But the big hazard we had early on in the movement was stories like to make up a fairy tale about their company. All the leaders were heroes and knights in shining armor, you know. And if they weren't playing out that value or playing out or living out that story, that could get them into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Lily back into the conversation, Lily Pang, because I'm curious, you know, what you hear in that about this idea of, you know, it's important in a story to reveal, like, a hero's weaknesses. Do you find that's true in your experience as well?
The more human the character is, the more relatable. And none of us are superhero, no weaknesses, no, you know, we've all got our faults. When we see a fault in somebody else, we go, all right, they're like me. Mm-hmm. I can relate to that.
It's why I hate Superman.
There you go.
Batman is more my speed.
Yeah. I like the depth it gives you. The more depth in a character or a story, whether it's a company story or a fable or a hero quest, the more we can love.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting when you were mentioning the stories we, you know, from families that we retell to ourselves. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about, like, family and how we structure stories there. I was just home recently and at dinner with my family, and my dad just prompted my younger brother to share this story about how he got horribly lost in Costa Rica, like on the wrong side of town. And he just prompted him to share that story, like apropos of nothing, just to essentially to hear it again. And, you know, like, why do you think we do that? Why do you think that when we gather, we all know the story? Like, I could tell you that story for my brother right now. I don't need to hear it again, but in a way, I do need to hear it again. Molly, you want?
I think we enjoy that. I think we enjoy reliving that. That's part. Those common stories are the stories we retell, are the things that connect us. And you could probably finish the story for him. There are elements. You may tell it when he isn't even around. And that's the kind of story I was referring to, that generations later, stories are told about my poor great-great-great Uncle Martin just for sheer entertainment, because he was such a character, you know. So it's a source of connectiveness, I think, for us as a family.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I also think we're affirming an identity. So we're affirming a character trait or a something. And so every time we retell a story about ourselves, we've got a whole range of stories about ourselves.
Or our family.
And our family and characters within our family. We're affirming an identity or a perception. And it's that whole thing too, like when you go back home and you're amongst your siblings, you behave a different way. You know, you go back into that sibling behavior.
It's more childish for me, the one that I slip into.
Yeah, and sometimes it has the old grudges and your humor gets a little bit, you know. So the stories we tell ourselves and others are what we live by. And if your father's asking for that story, he's proud of that son and what he managed to do and wants to live within that identity and connect with that, which is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's dangerous to, you know, repeat stories that are traumatic?
Oh, it depends when.
What do you mean by when? Like when we tell it, or what do you mean by when?
So it depends when in that person's involvement of the situation. If they've been through a hardcore trauma, you know, and you're telling it the next day and the next day and the next day, and it's repeated every day, and that's what their story is, then they don't get to leave that trauma, yeah, then it's not a good thing. If you've come through the process and you find a sense of peace with that trauma, with that event, and you tell that story, then that's fine. It's your story to tell. If someone else is telling a story about you and it's only trauma, or it's only when you make mistakes, or it's only when you've done something wrong, or you only mess up, then they're imposing an identity on you. They're imposing that you're that trauma, you're that mental illness, you're that muck-up kid who never did right. So it depends. A lot is on context.
Yeah, sometimes I also find that it's like, I want to save that person. Like, I'll see them slip into like this story, this negative story, and I want to help them, like, no, let's get away from that. But at the same time, I find that I don't want to, like, deny them that, like, part of themselves. And Molly, I'm curious if you've had similar experience.
Well, when I was thinking about it relative to business, we look often for stories of problems, either leadership mistakes, projects that didn't go well.
Right. Hires that didn't work.
Right. And we call them learning histories. Now, most organizations don't, they only want to mess with the success stories because they don't want to tell stories of failures. But what do we learn the most from? Usually our failures. And so in learning histories, I found if I took a story from another organization and told it in a different environment, then they could play with that story in the way of a scenario to see what could have been done differently. And if they're the stories of failures, usually some awful thing has happened that involved a wrong step in leadership or a system failure or whatever. And we tell those stories, and then they analyze them. And
they analyze the story.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And like the way that they tell that story?
Well, I usually tell the story to them, or sometimes they read it. But it sort of is an impersonal thing they can put out in front of them. They're not involved in it. They're not, it doesn't reflect anything on them. They're looking at the mechanics of it. Mm. And then they can figure out what might have been done differently to avoid the mistake that happened.
And Lily, how do you help someone, whether it be like in a corporate setting, but also in like a personal setting, move from like this, you know, cycle of repetitive trauma, like essentially like reinforcing that trauma, that story of trauma? How do you help them kind of like find a different way to find that resolution that you were referring to earlier in the show?
Da-da-da-da, bring in the traditional tale. That's what they're there for. That's the non-personal. That's the other corporation. That's the mm-hmm. Where do you see yourself in this story? Mm-hmm. Where does that character go to? Let's improvise. Let's play.
So do you do that with your family? Did you do that with your like brother?
My storytelling with my brother was my beginning. It was my training ground. It was where I started to discover and learn, and I wasn't as structured mm-hmm. about that. There are places where I do that now, and it depends on the situation and what support I have around. So if I'm working with refugees or if I'm working in a mental health center, it's actually if I'm going to go into that place, what supports are there for afterwards as well. So a lot of it is how deep we're going and under what circumstances and how the reception may be. Working with your own story is a deep thing. And even though it might sound glib and you can retell that story and I'll tell another story and we'll all just improv from there, the results afterwards are that someone's having an internal process of really thinking about their identity, and it's a growth process. And sometimes that's alone, and sometimes there's a step in that helps along the way. And that's what you're talking about in the corporate as well. It's that step in to help along the way in this story. And it's what's happening internally is a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Also, as teams work together, one thing that would be great is if they knew each other's beliefs, values, and how they operated, and also the assumptions. If you, for yourself, if you could evaluate the assumptions you're making about a situation. Mm-hmm. So often in processing these stories, after they've heard one of these stories, there will be a discussion and they will expose to each other their beliefs, values, and assumptions. And that's a hard thing to come by. I mean, if I asked you right now, what's your belief, values, and assumptions, you'd probably have a hard time making a list.
Yeah, it
but they will expose them in the course of the story.
Yeah. I'm curious, Lily, you did a lot of research about storytelling. Are there practical like brain development things that happen when we do stories? Like, are there psychological things that that unfold? Because I mean, you seem to be talking about feelings, but like, what do we know?
Okay, so we could.
Yeah.
There's a million places to start. There's research that there's the Healing Story Alliance, which has, you know, a whole group of people who work within healing stories. Within that, there's people who are going into juvenile justice, who are working with young people, young men in particular, who are looking for that male role model, who have grown up without that role model, who have ended up in gangs looking for that connection. And so they are telling them stories of initiation, of community, of quest, so that they can internally heal that sense of identity and move on. The story is a place where we are comfortable. I've got so many thoughts going on in my brain. One of them is the story, like, I work in hospitals with children who are can't move or can move a bit or are quarantined and things like that. So we take on a journey. We take on the play. We get the kids together and work with stories like a family who can't actually just rumble with a child, you know, just mess around. We make adventure stories and they have an experience together. And psychologically, our brain will give us the same endorphins and the same patterns within our brain are fired through an imaginative process as they are as if we actually go through that process. Mm-hmm. So in our brain, the switches are firing to experience that. It becomes a part of our experience. Storytelling, oral storytelling to a young child gives them something like 20,000 more words, understanding of words by the time they enter preschool, kindergarten. So by the time they're 5 years old, because you can read a book and there's three sentences on that page and one picture. But when I tell a story, my face is telling you what? Angry, sad, oh, I'm frustrated. You've just got three words and three definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't.
In an experiential way.
Yeah. So there is so much along our sense of development, our brain development, our literacy, I could explode trying to.
Yeah. Well, certainly more to learn. But I want to thank Lily Pang and Molly Catron for joining us this morning. Thank you both. And just want to correct something I said earlier. The National Storytelling Conference has actually started today, so you can find out more information about that online later this afternoon when we post more about this show. When we return, we'll hear from a former Star reporter who finds himself composing different kinds of stories now. We're coming right back at you in just a second. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. We're exploring the art of storytelling this hour as Kansas City prepares to host the National Storytelling Conference this week. We've been talking to two professional storytellers, but if we're going to be talking about how stories work, perhaps we should also hear one. Here's KCUR's Mike Russo sharing his story from the Flame KC event in February. And just a heads up, the story has some censored words because, well, it's from the recording business.
So I had this great plan when I was graduating college that I was going to go teach without a teaching certification, Teach for America, right? So that was literally the only plan I had. In fact, I picked up a degree, a history degree, because I thought that would make me better at doing that. It turns out I didn't get that, so then I didn't have a plan. So I went to the only professor that I was friends with, and I said, can you get me literally anything? I'll take any internship you have. And she said, can you live in New York? And I said, yeah, actually, my dad lives in New Jersey. I can sleep on his couch. And she was like, okay. And she called up somebody from MTV, and they said, well, we have this internship program, but it's only at TV Land, which is the rerun channel at MTV. And I was like, sold. So in 3 weeks after that, I was interning for free in Times Square in New York. And I was working at TV Land, and I watched probably every episode of The Munsters and I Love Lucy, just logging tapes for a long period of time, right? But I was really into video making, and that was my thing. And so while I was there, I would pass around actually mini DVs, if you remember what those are, and DVDs around of these stupid videos I was making of time-traveling plumber, various types of things, right? And finally, I stayed late enough, and I talked late enough to a producer that a guy was like, hey, my brother works at Atlantic Records. You like making videos. They're thinking about making videos that aren't music videos, you should interview for this job. So I did. And I went over to that interview, and he liked me a lot instantly. He liked the dumb videos that I had been making. I don't really know why, But so eventually he was like, okay, well, we're probably going to hire you, but actually Puff Daddy is here right now, and you should come down to the meeting right now and meet him. Okay. And so I went downstairs and I met, he was going by Diddy actually at the time. I went to meet Diddy, and Diddy was pissed drunk. And he had this great idea. He actually was going to have twins, and he wanted to tell the world that he was going to have twins. So my boss then, Paul, said, hey, well, we just hired a new video guy. I didn't know I was hired yet. And he can record you, and we can tell the world. So my first job there was recording Diddy, telling the world that he had twins. I went home that night, and I said, well, Dad, I think I got the job. And so he was like, well, son, you can never dress up too much for your first day at the work. So I had my only tie that I had, and he gave me an oversized blazer, and I went to go work at Atlantic Records. And the first day that I get in there, the president of Atlantic Records and all of the, she has a crazy persona. I walk into a meeting. I'm a little bit late, and immediately she points at me, and she goes, how the f*** is new guy wearing a tie? I don't pay f***ing new guy enough to wear a tie. And that was my second day on the job, actually my first day on the job. She had this grand scheme that all the young people were scalping tickets and that I was part of that, I guess. She never learned my name, ever. She called me New Guy for the entire time that I worked at Atlantic Records. Living in New York is very pricey, right? And so I lived in Bushwick with about 13 people. And we had to have a bunch of people living there. And one day I came home and there was this big smell, this odor. And what that smell was a long-dreaded kid who was there who rode bikes and dumpster dove and things like that. And we became really good friends. And he was like, hey, do you want to ride across the country on bikes and be in a metal band? And I was like, yeah, that actually sounds kind of good. I think I could do that. So after being at Atlantic Records for about 2 years, I went to the same person who never learned my name and said, hey, I think I'm actually going to ride my bike in the Midwest for a long time. And she goes, cool. If you walk out that door, you will never work here ever again. And but lo and behold, I worked there 2 years later. No, just kidding. I've been running a failing record label ever since. And so that's it. Thanks, guys.
That was KCUR's Mike Russo. When he's not running his record label into the ground, he's also KCUR's senior media and community engagement producer. In that story, we heard a lot about drastic change and changes a professional fortune. And we're going to bring into the conversation Mike Rice. He's a local playwright, but he hasn't always done that his entire life. Mike, welcome to Central Standard. And real quick,
thank you.
I'm really curious what you heard is the universal in Mike Russo's story.
The universal. Well, I found it interesting about the wearing the tie. Mm-hmm. I remember wearing a tie to my first day at the job, but didn't get any kind of feedback like that.
Perhaps journalism is a slightly softer, more affirming place than...
In some ways, yes, yeah, and others, no.
But yeah, tell me about that. So you were a reporter for The Star for a number of years.
I was a reporter at The Star from 1988 to 2008.
And then you got into playwriting. How did that happen?
What happened is that after I left The Star, my entire life I've always had a desire to write something, and my time at The Star fed that desire for a while. And then after leaving The Star, I, you know, began thinking about, you know, writing plays. That happened, you know, a few years after I left The Star. And what happened is that I one night I went to a play over Labor Day weekend 2 years ago at the Fish Tank, and just wanting to find out more about that venue, I went on their website and found out that they were having a playwriting workshop, and I decided, you know, this is something I really want to do, and I did, and had a great instructor there named Brian Moses, and that's how this play that I've written for Fringe Festival, that's where it started. At that workshop in the fall of 2014.
What's the play called?
The play is called John and Leslie Are in the Copy Room Again. Oh. And it's going to be playing at the Phosphor Studio along with three other plays that that are being directed by Brian Moses. He's directing my play. It stars Pete Bakley, Kelly Maine, and Elizabeth Hillman. And like I said, it'll be five performances of my play, the first one being on Friday night.
Cool. And I was thinking about Mike Russo's story, and my feeling is that it worked pretty well as like a story, like a performance. But it wouldn't work as well as a play. And
well, I mean, it could. You can turn, I think you can turn any kind of story into a play.
Oh, really?
I mean, if you have you know, the right characters and the right mood, I think you can turn that in. It, obviously, I think a story like that has to have a hook. I think any play worth its while is going to have that hook. Mm-hmm. And it's going to have a dramatic question of, you know, is this going to happen? Is that going to occur?
Mm. And so what do you feel like are the differences between writing like a news story, which ostensibly also has its own kind mm-hmm. of hook, and putting a play together?
The big difference is with a news story, you are basing that story on facts.
One hopes.
Well, exactly. Sometimes you wonder if that's occurring lately in modern journalism. But with a play, you don't have those rules. You can, a play is fiction, and you can bend those rules and embellish a few things.
Was that hard for you to make that transition to like think in such like a kind of linear way with reporting, to kind of have that freedom?
Not really. I mean, by the time I wrote this play 2 years ago, I'd been gone from the Star for 6 years, so I wasn't I didn't really have that. Is someone going to change this or that? Just but yeah, no, I didn't. I didn't really have difficulties making that transition.
Did your work in journalism impact the way you think about dialogue? Because I find like a play is essentially
yes.
straight dialogue.
Yes, I don't really think I would have been able to write this play without the 20 years of experience that I had as a reporter, mainly because those 20 years I spent there gave me a lifetime experience. I don't think I could have written any play when I was in my 20s, let alone even my early 30s, because I just didn't really have that lifetime experience. Mm-hmm. I really admire, you know, some of these younger playwrights in their 20s that are able to write these great plays because it's just, I mean, that just takes a special talent.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like there are opportunities for the news to be more like a play? Like, do you think that there needs to be more of what Lily was referring to, the kind of like this bend between, well, not necessarily fact and fiction, but between like spectacle and performance and that kind of thing in journalism?
I think so. I think, you know, you can take any enterprise or feature story, even a hard news story, and make a play out of that. I really do. If you think creatively, I believe, you know, I during my career at the Star, I covered a great share of city council meetings from various municipalities here in the Kansas City area, and to me, there were plenty of. I think of some of those meetings and the subjects and yeah, I could think of a couple plays or two to
power, intrigue, and
yeah,
and politics.
Exactly.
Well, Central Standard has come to a close. I want to thank Mike, Lily, and Molly for joining us. Mike Rice, he's a local playwright, former Star reporter, in his play John and Leslie Are in the Copy Room Again is at the Fringe Festival July 22nd through the 30th. Lily Pang is a professional storyteller, and she joined us earlier in the show, as well as Molly Catron. If you would like to catch this conversation again, we have it posted to kcur.org/centralstandard. That will happen later this afternoon. Central Standard returns tomorrow with a conversation about Olympic hopefuls, a look at if barbecue and the electric slide can soothe racial and police tensions, and we'll also have some music. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and myself. Our team also includes Brian Ellison, Suzanne Hogan, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, and a Sterlitz Central Standards intern. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. Gina Kaufman is on leave, and Up to Date is next.